All right, the long-awaited awards pod here. A little bit late, March 6th, but this is our monthly catch-up on where we see the awards through the NBA season. A lot of interesting stuff to get to. A lot of players are surging. We've had some injuries as well. Be interesting to see how much things have changed. So, Danny, why don't we get started here? Who is your MVP through this point of the season?
And just as one other point of clarification, these are not predictions on where it's going to go from here or anything like that. It is if the season ended, and I do mine rigidly on the end of that month, what it would be at that point using our own criteria. And for MVP, a lot of guys, I think this is more about players ascending rather than I have Harden number one. I had Giannis before, but Harden, he's played a little bit more, gotten that balance, and he's having just a spectacular year. I mean, offensively, it's not only that he's been incredibly efficient, but he has been a huge part of Houston's offense. Houston's offense has been spectacular. 115.8, so 116 offensive rating with him on the floor. 7.4 point difference in offensive rating. And remember, they have a fabulous bench because Chris Paul often plays when Harden does not. So I had him one. Giannis, who, for those who remember, was a surprise, I had him first at the end of January. Just, I don't think he was as good, and now the minute differential has narrowed with time. But then the people that really rose into this, and I have them at 3 and 4, I don't usually go that deep, but I felt like I needed to this time. Jimmy Butler is a different kind of case because he hasn't had as outstanding a season as those guys. You know, you could look at PER, effectiveness as an offensive player, but you see the proof in the pudding with how the Wolves have struggled without him, and I think that's an important difference in terms of value. And he played a crap ton of minutes when he was still healthy, and at the end of February, he had still played a ton of minutes. And then Anthony Davis, Western Conference Player of the Month, we talked about that in the 15 and 60. 28.8 PER, 6.16 true shooting, 27 usage. And his case is actually strangely similar to Giannis's in that they're both very important parts of their offense, but bringing defensive value as well. And they have supporting talent, but they are really clearly the best players on their team. So I think that's by 1 through 4. LeBron is close. And Steph Curry, if it were a per minute award, would be close too, but it's not, so he's not.
Harden, number 2 in the league in RPM behind his teammate Chris Paul, leads the league 7.47. offensive RPM. Steph Curry is second. He is my choice as well, and a very easy one if you need it even more. Tim McMahon wrote a good piece today with help from Micah Adams at ESPN on how good Harden overall has been in the clutch, although interesting to watch here that when Harden plays with Paul in the clutch, he plays a lot better than without, and last year he was not as good in the clutch. So that's going to be one of the most important themes going forward is how good is James Harden in the clutch, because you know they're giving it to him every single time. He and Chris Paul, and he's probably going to end up ISOing off of a pick and roll switch nearly every single time. Number 2 for me was a little bit more difficult. Giannis and AD definitely lower in the RPM, specifically the offensive RPM, and they are 10th and 12th overall. I agree with you, Steph Curry would be up there for me as well. LeBron has turned it around a little bit after that rancid January, but between him, AD, and Giannis, it's very close. Probably would still have Giannis second. I think we've fallen into a little bit of recency bias here with AD, and I also the issue his inconsistency, it's almost actually more useful now because he'll have these, and he's had a lot of games where he's blown up lately, to be sure, but you know, he'll have these games where he totally disappears. He has the highest variance of any NBA superstar, at least the last time that I saw someone write about that. But now that the team has less talent around him, those games where he blows up push them to victory, and they're probably going to lose the games where he was just going to be pretty ordinary anyway, as opposed to before when they had a little bit more talent. When you'd get a disappointing game, you know, when they're favored in more games, when you get a disappointing game, then that brings you below what your baseline should expect. So I think actually the worse the team is, kind of the more useful in terms of winning games his talents can be. But yeah, I would have AD third right now, LeBron fourth, but really Giannis, LeBron, AD, it could be in any order. Butler, just not quite at the level for me as a scorer, as a first option. And now, of course, he's going to miss the next month and really fall out of this. Anything you wanted to react to there, or shall we move on?
Couple small things. One that's always a challenge with this is I look and I write this down. I call it differential. So it's basically the net rating difference when a player is on versus off. The challenge with that is for a lot of these teams, those players are, their minutes are aligned with other really good players. And so especially if it's like that and a team has a bad bench. So that can be kind of a factor in this. One thing I wanted to mention though with Jimmy, the reason why I had him third behind Harden and Giannis is also that when he's been on the floor, the Wolves have defended well. They have had an awful defensive season overall as a team, and part of that is because their second unit doesn't have much defense. And I think Jimmy Butler is their best defensive player. Taj is solid as well. Towns has his moments, but I give him some credit for that, and you see them fall off a lot defensively when he's not on the floor.
Yeah, part of that is that opponent jump shooting luck has been really bad for the Wolves when he's been off the floor, and better for them when he's been on. Certainly he helps with that a little bit. He helps with the volume, but that effect I think is overstated just a little bit, although certainly still does exist. All right, we'll get to All NBA in a second here. First, this from NetSuite by Oracle. It's the business management software that handles every aspect of your business in an easy to use cloud platform. If you've outgrown QuickBooks, if you're still using shared spreadsheets and these manual processes, a bunch of old legacy systems, NetSuite can save you time, money, and those unneeded headaches by managing sales, HR, and finance and accounting instantly right from your desk or even on your phone. You can use it as well. NetSuite is more affordable than you think. And right now, if you want to get started with them, learn a little bit more about how NetSuite works, they're offering you valuable insights to help you overcome the obstacles that are holding you back. Free. They've got this free guide, which is useful even if you don't end up using NetSuite, Crushing the Five Barriers to Growth. You can learn how to acquire new customers, increase profits, and finally get real visibility into your cash flow. That's NetSuite's guide, Crushing the Five Barriers to Growth. Go to netsuite.com/capspace. Easy to remember that URL. We talk about capspace all the time on the program here. netsuite.com/capspace to download the free Crushing the Five Barriers to Growth guide today. netsuite.com/capspace. Let them know that you came from us. So first team All-NBA, Harden obviously is going to be on there for both of us, but I suspect that some of the other categories will be slightly more controversial here. I don't think that necessarily any of the other four slots are just fait accompli obvious at all here now.
Agreed completely. I shift for All-NBA more towards most outstanding rather than most valuable, so
yeah.
Time played is less important, and also, you know, like, so Jimmy Butler, I made the case where I had him high in MVP. He's a lot lower here because the on-off difference isn't as much as like who's the better player, who's having the better season. So my first team, Harden, and then I think Steph Curry has been the second best guard in the league. Again, going to outstanding instead of valuable helps him a lot.
But let's talk about Steph for a second. I had him as well. I think it's easier here to go position by position to some degree. Lillard has really come on. We talked about that. I mean, he is, if he keeps playing like this for the rest of the season, you know, he's going to get close to that category. We'll see what Steph plays like the rest of the season. Having missed the month doesn't help him, though. Like you, I tend to gravitate a little bit more to who I think the better player is overall. Curry, as of this writing, I always say as of this writing because as of this speaking doesn't really seem to make much sense.
As of this podcast,
we're not writing
or recording.
As of this recording. All right, yeah, that's what we'll use from now. Only played 48 games. That's only 7 less than Harden, though. Remember, Harden had that hamstring injury as well. And Giannis is at 60 at the moment. Lillard has played 57. It's only 2 more than Harden, though. I think Portland has played a couple more games overall. Lillard has missed some time here as well. And just in the modern day NBA, you know, 75 games is kind of the new 82 when you just consider rest and that teams are more cautious with injuries, etc. But Steph Curry, he's still 5th in PER. He has the better history of any of these players. Offensive RPM, he was 1st through most of the year. Now he's still 2nd in that and still has more gravity off ball than just about everyone. I would love to see now a couple years removed from him having to be the guy who creates all the time of just what he would look like, you know, if he were, say, on the Blazers and trying to play that game that Dame Lillard played last night against the Lakers that we recorded on. That was just this unbelievable performance in the fourth quarter. And maybe he wouldn't be quite as effective there, maybe if he was in a system where he had to just create his own shot. But even going back to that in the Mark Jackson days, which was basically that system, he was still an extremely effective first-team All-NBA type of player, I thought, that last year. The gravity is just too much. And then defensively, compared to a lot of point guards. I think he actually, you know, is a better help defender and team defender. So he would still be it for me. But, you know, I'm not going to completely foreclose the idea that Lillard could pass him, even though I still don't even have Lillard as my second team guard either as of this moment. But that's foreshadowing.
I have him. Well, do you want to just go through all the guards right now? Because that's actually the way that I thought about this.
Yeah. Maybe we can approach this a little bit differently.
Yeah,
because we did before, and then we'll just summarize the teams at the end.
Yeah, so where I ran into an issue, I have Chris Paul as the third best guard in the league. I have been a Chris Paul believer for a long time, and yeah, I think RPM overstates it for him by a meaningful margin. But he's been fabulous when he's played this year, and it was weird, you know, doing the Twitter NBA show for one of his worst games this season, but he's been great. So I have him as the third best guard so far. Lillard, I have as the last guy on the second team, but the way I decided this, it was a real challenge. So I had Lillard, Westbrook, Kyrie, Kemba, and Victor Oladipo all fairly close. I mean, they're all within kind of the same band. And so I'm sitting there going, okay, well, there's one spot here, then two spots on the third team, and then two spots in the quote-unquote honorable mention. And I ended up going with Lillard because none of the other point guards were really generating. Like, it's so weird this year that a lot of the best offenses have offensive engines that don't play the point guard position, but these guys are still incredibly important. So, like, the top 10 offenses, beyond, like, Indiana with Oladipo and Darren Collison and things like that. But I thought Lillard was the most important of those guys for his team's offensive success, and he's done a wonderful job. I feel better about that because I locked that in on March 1st before they played that day. Since then, I felt even better about it, but I have him there. Do you want to react to that, or do you want me to go through my whole thing?
No, please go through the whole thing.
Okay, so then I'm sitting there with Westbrook, Kyrie, Kemba, and Oladipo, and I ended up going
So why is Lillard better than Kyrie to you right now? Because I've always been higher on Lillard than a lot of people, but just looking at their overall season stats, I think it's still hard to construct an argument that he's been better than Irving over the course of the full season.
I think that the reason for me is the degree of difficulty of what he's doing. I mean, Kyrie is in a more favorable circumstance. There are, you know, playing with Horford, I think, has really helped that. I think their system and...
Yeah, the spacing that they have. I mean, even though they don't have, like, these awesome three-point shooters, I mean, Jaylen Brown, Jason Tatum, like, those guys can shoot well enough. Horford...
And Horford's such a great glue guy. Imagine what Lillard could do if he had a center that could set screens, pop, and do and pass well out of the circumstances when he has it. And McCollum is great, but he's a different type. He's not the same kind of collaborator that Horford is. And I like what Portland runs, but I think Boston gives them the advantages. And defensively, neither one of those guys is great, but I don't know. I think that wasn't really a tiebreaker for any of these players, which was also weird because none of them, I mean, Oladipo and Westbrook came in as hyped defensive talents. I don't think either one of those guys is adding too much on that end. And then Kemba, Kyrie.
Oladipo at least is getting a lot of steals. I mean, I think he's taken some steps forward this year.
Yeah, he's better than he's been, but it's not really adding much to his
numbers.
Value.
His defensive numbers in as far as RPM are outstanding, although some of that could be the box score prior. I think he's got like a plus 2.64.
Wow. Defensive I didn't RPM, realize it was that high.
Since considering most guards are actually below zero in that stat, I mean, that is remarkable. I mean, it's something to look into a little bit more. I'm not going to put that much stock in it, especially because, you know, you look at who some of his backups are as well. But in any event, yeah. So you've got Lillard. Who's your other second team guard?
Chris Paul.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's really, you're really just splitting hairs between all these guys. Ugh. For me, I had Irving, who is going to miss some more time here potentially this week as a guy who's played a few more games. The Celtics have still been really good. They've still been totally good offensively when he's been on the floor. And, you know, I agree that he's trending down. Also, you have to throw in his clutch performance as well to some degree. Again, not as important to me in All-NBA, but still matters. I think he's been the best of these guys there. So I had Irving and then Jimmy Butler as my two second-team All-NBA guards. I know you had Butler as a forward. I out of stubbornness, I'm sticking with him as a guard, but I think that's really how he's introduced and how he's probably been seen as more of a shooting guard than a small forward these last few years, just because that's the position he's been listed at, even though we all know he can play small forward just fine and his skill set's a little bit more as a small forward. But yeah, and then you throw in Chris Paul and Lillard to me were on the third team, but I mean, we could see to me any of these guys being on second team and maybe even Lillard, just because he's been so nuclear this last 20 games or so. If he he just continues to play at that for another 20 games, you know, he could even surpass Steph to me. But I still think over the entire course of the season, Irving and Butler, their body of work is just a little bit better to me than Chris Paul and Lillard, but it is extremely close, right?
I had one more guard spot because I have Jimmy Butler as a forward, and yes, of course, he makes one of my All-NBA teams. And so I gave that spot to Russell Westbrook over Kemba and Oladipo. He has been very important to Oklahoma City's offense so far, and his defensive rebounding does provide some value. It's overstated, but it does help there. And Kemba is, to a degree, sabotaged by his bench. I think he's closer to All-NBA for me than he will be for other people, which is a shame because he deserves consideration, heavy consideration, as does Oladipo. But I think Russ has just been slightly better. And while I don't factor it in as much as you do, the idea of him, just Russell Westbrook's previous success and the idea of kind of where that's going, it was a little bit, I wouldn't say it was even a tiebreaker, but I did have it in the back of my mind.
DeMar DeRozan is the other guy you probably at least need to be talked
absolutely
about.
I should have mentioned
here.
Him too.
But he's dropped off a little bit. He's basically now back to league average in true shooting percentage. He's got that 29% usage. People know this about him, but his ability to avoid turnovers is really impressive. Adding the three ball is good. But in terms of, if you look at some of the stats, DeRozan is 25th in PER this year, though that includes a lot of short minute guys. So if you wanted to do it in terms of guys who are actually candidates here, he would be a lot higher on that list, but is not even in the top 40 in RPM right now. And so it's still difficult to put him into quite the same category as the guys who are great both in the box score and in the on-off stuff.
It'll also be hard for him to move much higher in RPM, considering the Raptors, last time I checked, had a higher net rating when he was off the floor than when he was on the floor. And yes, they have that, but that crazy bench lineup that has the league's best net rating of any lineup that has played more than 150 minutes or whatever it was is a big part of that. But, you know, that factors in with RPM for sure. So let's go on to the forwards. There's a lot of balance and challenges and everything here.
Yeah, there is, and especially with the positions as well, because, you know, are you going to have AD as a forward or as a center? I think he's playing more center. Now he's probably playing 80%, if not more, of his minutes at center. They're giving Emeka Okafor the Keith Bogans, but then Okafor was out, so they actually finally bit the bullet and started AD at center just because they have nobody else. It would have to be Cheick Diallo otherwise. Diallo has actually looked okay at times, but probably not someone that you want starting. But I still had AD as a forward, and so AD, Kevin Durant, LeBron James, and Giannis are really all pretty neck and neck. I'd have Durant a little bit below his defense. I mean, it's crazy that he's getting that defensive player of the year buzz. He actually has a negative defensive RPM this year. I think when he locks in, he can be pretty good, but I don't think he's been a huge plus for the Warriors on defense this year. And while he is a very scalable player in terms of his ability to play off the ball, he doesn't have the same type of creation responsibilities, not the same type of passer that he was in Oklahoma City. And he certainly fits into the Warriors system well. But then when you also look at their offense, when Steph has been out, you know, he has not been able to push them to that same degree. So he's a little bit below those guys, in my opinion. And so then it becomes between LeBron, Giannis, and AD, you've got two spots there for first team All-NBA forward. Is that how you saw it also?
That is how I saw it. And at this point, I gave those spots to Giannis and AD. I think they've been better than LeBron overall this season. And that was surprising to me. I wasn't expecting to come in with both LeBron and Durant not on the first team, but those guys have been better. And I'm not going to use that sort of history stuff for them. And it's so close that we could see it go in a different direction in, I guess that'd be April when we end up doing that. But
yeah, I'm not quite ready to take the second best player of all time and the player that's, I think, still most people would say is the best player in the NBA until we really see somebody else outplay him in the playoffs. I realize he hasn't had that great of a season, and maybe this could be the beginning of the drop off for him. This is the first time really he's been way negative in defensive RPM. The fact that they've been worse with him off the floor, that's all concerning, but I'm not ready to do it yet to take him off first team All-NBA.
The reason I did it is because of this argument. I don't know if Bill Simmons had this first, but I do find this very persuasive, which is when you're telling the story of this season on the positive way, who are you telling that story about? And for me, Giannis, especially in the early part of this season, is woven into the fabric, and AD at this point, and LeBron has had a good year overall, but it hasn't been definitive. And yes, his team is probably going to end up
except
third in
when
the
they Eastern. Won 16 out of 17 games and he looked awesome then. But
I realize
he was so bad in January.
Oh my god, he was bad. You're right about the 16 and 17. I I should have given more credit to that. But
and he's been awesome in the clutch this year too. I think better than either of those two guys. Although AD, the Pels certainly
they've had to play a lot of it, and they've had to play a lot of it. And the Pelicans have had to recently, and they've done very well as well.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was.
I totally understand your point. I'm not there yet. I mean, I realize that. I mean, these are three of the top four guys in the NBA in PER. AD and Giannis are 12th and 10th in RPM respectively. LeBron all the way down at 20th. But if you look at offensive RPM, LeBron is way above those guys. And I still think that offense is more important than defense. LeBron still is the fourth best offensive RPM in the NBA. And Giannis and AD, those guys are down at 20th and below.
I don't know why I'm setting this arbitrary limit on myself, but I've set the line that if Davis plays 45% or more of his minutes at center on the using cleaning the glasses differentiation at the end of the year, I'm going to count him as a center. And if it's less than that, I'm not comfortable. Because to me, if it's 60-40 or something in that range, I just can't count a guy as a center if that's the disparity. And in his circumstance, I think it's completely fair with how they're doing it. I mean, he's the four when they're playing with Cousins, though he sometimes has those defensive responsibilities. And with Okafor, he's obviously the four as well. So I think that's reasonably fair. So 45% is my line. If it's at 44 and he's really better than Joel Embiid, I'm not going to guarantee it. That's why I'm not binding myself to this, but that is pretty much where it is.
Third team for my forwards, I had Paul George, who has been coming on lately, at least offensively, although their defense, as we'll get to, has certainly been troubling of late. That's not his fault, though. But he also hasn't been able to improve them totally, and neither has he been able to do that in Indiana the last couple of years either. But, you know, the surrounding talent is not amazing. And then my other one, because I did not have Jimmy Butler on my as a forward, I still stuck with Al Horford, although he's been slumping a little bit of late. But there's just really, who else is it going to be? It would have to be Draymond Green. It would have to be Ben Simmons, who, you know, is still pretty good. I mean, those would probably be your other two forwards if you want to count Simmons as a forward. Then you're going down to like Blake Griffin and Kevin Love type of levels. The depth at forward is not what it used to be back in the golden era when there are all these awesome power forwards, for example, and the small forward position has probably less depth than anything else. And we're really missing Kawhi Leonard this year as well at the small forward position.
We are. And remember early in the season when I think it was the first awards we did, the guards were really weak and we both said, this is going to get a lot better. And then it absolutely did. I mean, that's not a surprise. But so mine, I had Durant over Butler. Even though I had it the other way for MVP, I think Durant's been more outstanding. Butler's been more valuable. And then my last spot went to Paul George. I think he's clearly the sixth best according to my stuff. I think he's been fabulous offensively this month. He's been solid overall. And then defensively, he's provided a lot of value too. So I had him there. Center, again, definitional problems are important here. I counted both LaMarcus Aldridge and Al Horford as centers. And would be, if it were coming down to a spot, I would actually be okay with fudging one or both of those if the center, like if let's say Davis moves to center, depending on how it shakes out, I might be okay with that just because they're on the borderline. I mean, Aldridge and both those guys often don't start at center, so you could make that argument. I think Embiid has been the best of the trio. Those are my three, by the way. I think Embiid has been the best so far, so I have him first team. I'm going to talk about him more in a different category a little bit, so I'll save most of that for there. Aldridge, second team, I believe I had that last month as well. Defensive value, and he's been so important offensively for the Spurs this year without Kawhi. I think to a point, it's been underappreciated, though, as the Spurs keep falling, even though some of that has come without him on the floor. And then Horford, the two-way player idea, he's been so important for Boston's defense. He does help their offense sing. There is this big disparity where their offense goes off the table when Kyrie's off the floor, but a lot of that is because their minutes are connected with Al Horford. So I had those guys over Towns and Jokic, who I think are the next two, and they're both having wonderful years, but at the center position, I lean more towards defense than offense, and I think Horford and Aldridge have been better defensively than Towns and Jokic.
Yeah, I had Aldridge first still, but I would imagine after next month, especially since Aldridge had that sprained ankle and it didn't play well in his first game back, it could take him a while to get back into that. The Spurs are kind of in free fall here also. So he's still my first team center, just based on volume over Embiid. One thing that's a difference between those two guys that's a massive advantage for Aldridge, though, is turnover rate. Embiid turns it over on 14% of his possessions. And when you have a 31% usage, that's a lot of turnovers. Whereas Aldridge, he has the lowest turnover rate, 6.4% of his possessions end in a turnover, which is absolutely remarkable. There's a lot of guys with phenomenally low turnover rates this year, too. I mean, Kyrie is 8%, AD never turns it over, he's 8%, Jimmy Butler is only 7.2% turnover rate, DeRozan never turns it over, Kemba Walker is incredible incredibly low in that as well. But Aldridge is the lowest of any player in the top 30 in PER. He has the lowest turnover rate. And so to have it be less than half Embiid is underrated. But again, I mean, for all those guys too, it's really close. Embiid was my second team. And then I actually, since I didn't have Horford, although even if he were the center, I probably would have Towns over him at this point. But Karl Towns was my third team center. And Rudy Gobert, I just really wish he had played a few more games, because, you know, he would be right up there for me as well, at least for third team All-NBA center. And just what they've been doing defensively with him on the floor has been incredible since he returned from injury. So should we go through just our first team, first, second, and third team, since that might have been a little confusing here?
Yeah, let's do it like, so first team, I go, you go, then second team, I go, you go. Let's do it that way. So my first team, Harden, Curry, Giannis, Davis, Embiid.
Yeah, I had Steph, James Harden, LeBron, Giannis, and LaMarcus Aldridge. And then my second team, Irving and Jimmy Butler at the guards, Kevin Durant and Anthony Davis at forward, and Joel Embiid at center.
I had Chris Paul, Damian Lillard, LeBron James, Kevin Durant, LaMarcus Aldridge. And then my third team, Russell Westbrook, Kyrie Irving, Jimmy Butler, Paul George, Al Horford.
Yeah, and for me, Paul and Lillard on the guard line, George and Al Horford at forward, and then Karl Towns at center. So let's talk Defensive Player of the Year now. You alluded to it. Joel Embiid is yours, I am guessing, and he would be mine as well.
Philadelphia has it. They're allowing less than a point per possession with Embiid on the floor, 106.3 with him off the floor. Big difference in shots at the rim proportion and success, 26% versus 30%, which is a huge difference in the restricted area, and making 59.5% with him on and 65.1% with him off. And they have Amir Johnson and Rashawn Holmes, so you would hope that that number would be actually a little bit better than that. And his 53.7% opponent field goal percentage at the rim is, it's not best in the league. It's behind a couple of guys. Porzingis, actually Jakob Poeltl, surprisingly enough, is on that list. But, you know, he is the best defender of that group. And I would love to see Gobert, you know, if he had theoretically played more, it would have been a more interesting discussion. Rudy Gobert, to me, has not played enough at this point, probably will not have played enough at the end of the season to be worthy of winning this award in my eyes.
Yeah, Gobert has just been so incredibly outstanding, and there's not really a great second candidate behind Embiid. So he would actually be second for me now. That's a little anticipatory. He's only played 38 games. But again, Draymond has fallen off. We talked about this last month. His advanced stats are not good compared to where he's been. So he's not really in the conversation. Even Horford, well, he plays a lot of minutes with Kyrie and he's got to prop him up a little bit. There's still not really any better when he's off the floor than when he's on. He's a very solid defensive player, but, you know, not a game changing, you know, he's good at denying penetration. He can move his feet, but he's not just, hey, we cannot challenge this guy. But Defensive Player of the Year, we talked about this before, how the absolute best offenses in the NBA have solutions for these kind of, you just can't score on them at the rim type of big men. But, you know, 25 of the teams in the NBA don't have a solution, and this is a regular season award.
You want to do Coach of the Year now?
Yeah, I still had Brad Stevens, although the Celtics have continued to fall off a little bit after that hot start, but they've had a reasonable amount of injury concerns. Also, the train keeps right on rolling, though, for them. And then Dwayne Casey was my number two. I moved Greg Popovich down again with some of these recent struggles for the Spurs. Others receiving votes for me, Nate McMillan, Terry Stotts, Quinn Snyder, and Doc Rivers at this point. But that's my top three, is Stevens, Casey, and Popovich. But if the Spurs continue to really founder, then I could see Popovich falling out of this entirely. Because, you know, they're kind of getting to the point now where the whole argument for him was, wow, like, if you had to predict how they'd be before the season without Kawhi Leonard, look where they're at. They're so much better. But if they're not really, if they're going to finish only, you know, 10 games over 500 this year or even less than that, it's kind of, you know, about maybe what you would have expected without Kawhi, maybe 15 games worse where you'd see them with Kawhi for the whole season as a 60 win type of team.
I actually still have Pop 1, but that was because I did it on March 1st. And as they keep on shifting on this, I'm moving. And I have Casey second as well, but I could very well, I see Casey winning the award. That's not relevant necessarily what we're doing, but I wanted to mention it. And what I like so much about
you think Casey will win it over Brad Stevens?
I do think Casey will win it.
It just seems like the Celtics just get so much more attention. And also the other thing too is, like, while it is a one season award, I think especially in recent years that, you know, we don't have the, like, Sam Mitchell Coach of the Year one season blip kind of awards anymore. Just like, like, oh, who exceeded expectations?
Well, what about Budenholzer? I mean, they had a couple of years, but yeah. Budenholzer winning it over Kirk.
He came out of that. Oh, yeah. But I mean, but that's like, yeah, that wouldn't have been a matchup. But nonetheless, Budenholzer,
I think that's what's going to happen this year. But yeah. Stevens, yeah, it could be, it's not a lifetime achievement award because he's so damn young, but a, like, hey, he's been one of the best coaches in the league for the last 3 years, and so might as well give him this one. I would be totally fine with Stevens winning it, but what Casey has done that I love is they've changed so much about this team without changing much of the personnel, and that is a really, really hard thing to do. We don't see it very often, and it has taken for the most part. You know, DeMar DeRozan has changed his offensive game. They're moving the ball better, and they've been able to cultivate these young players to make
and,
a bench possible.
And getting them to defend without, you know, if you just looked at their roster, it was young guys. They didn't have, I mean, maybe Serge Ibaka, but, you know, he's on the downside now. Didn't have just this group of awesome established defensive players that you're looking at it, and they've been a top five defense this year. So that's very impressive. But I just think, like, Brad Stevens, he hasn't won one yet. He's been considered one of the top coaches for a long time, and there's just been so much more media attention on Boston than Toronto, unfairly, despite Toronto's vastly superior season at this point. Okay, biggest surprise team and biggest surprise player. I'll stick with mine from last month. I have the Boston Celtics still as the biggest surprise team without Gordon Hayward. Although the Indiana Pacers are now 10 games over 500. I mean, they are closing fast in this. And then that dovetails with my biggest surprise player. That is Victor Oladipo. And I really don't think anyone else is even close to Oladipo in that category, though. Please correct me if you think I'm wrong on that.
I do not think you're wrong. I have Oladipo. I don't even have any honorable mentions there. And my biggest surprise team, I have the Pacers and Celtics honorable mention there, is the Raptors, because the change that they made to get to be a 60-win team and to be one of the best teams in the league. Like, this isn't,
we had them at like 45, 46 wins.
Right.
We thought there's no way they're going to be better in the regular season this year than they've been the last couple of years.
Like, this is the equivalent of going from being an all-star to being like second or first team All-NBA. And those jumps don't happen very often for a team like the Raptors that didn't turn over very much. And I was impressed with that. You know, Indiana, their offense, they've been making a bunch of shots. I'm impressed with them, what they've done for sure. But that is Toronto, a team that we thought, you know, was like, oh, they're going to, you know, they'll win maybe like high 40s and then they'll get, they'll lose disappointingly in the playoffs. It's like, oh no, they're the third best team in the NBA right now.
Yeah, actually, my second, probably, and this is tough to do for a rookie, but I mean, Donovan Mitchell would probably be my second biggest surprise, just as a guy who's drafted number 13 to be doing this. You know, granted, he got some buzz from Mike Schmidt, who deserves a ton of credit there for picking him for rookie of the year before the start of the season. I thought he was completely insane, and apparently I was way wrong on that one.
Well, so did you know that David Locke said on, he said on Real GM Radio before the year when we did the capsule preview, that he's predicted Donovan Mitchell is going to score 15 points a game, and I said, you're completely insane. But there was an opportunity issue there originally, because they had, you know, Rubio and Hood and all these other guys in front of him.
Yeah.
But to do that, and then what I said to him after that was, if he gets 15 points a game, he's going to be in the conversation for rookie of the year. And I meant that more as like, kind of like, he's not going to do that. He's not going to be rookie of the year. And that ended up being like, it ended up being right in a different way. It was funny.
Yeah, that's pretty remarkable. I think, I mean, if I had to say some others other than Mitchell, Spencer Dinwiddie, Fred VanVleet, Tyreke Evans, even though, you know, he's kind of been lost in the shuffle here with this injury and somehow not getting traded. Biggest disappointing team and player.
Biggest disappointing team was actually a really big challenge for me, because so many of the teams that have disappointed has been due to injuries, and I don't count that. That's not fair. You know, if a player like Mike Conley being out for the year, yeah, Memphis has been bad, but Mike Conley's been out, so that's not a big deal. So the team I went with is probably going to make the playoffs, but Miami, I expected, if they were as healthy as they've been, that they would be a real, you know, the idea with them was always like, oh, if they're healthy, they'll be very good, but they haven't had that kind of luck, and they haven't been perfect. I mean, Waiters has been a bunch of time, but he is more replaceable than a lot of the other guys that they have, and they're, you know, probably going to be one of the bottom, right now it looks like they're going to be one of the bottom two seeds in the East, and that is disappointing. It's not nearly as disappointing as you could pick in a lot of other years, but there just aren't the same kind of candidates for me, and I'm interested to see if you have a very different opinion, because you very well could. I just couldn't think of a good example. example.
For biggest disappointing team, you're saying?
Yeah.
How about the Cleveland Cavaliers? Like, how are they any less disappointing than they were last month? I mean, they've come on a little bit after the trade. I mean, like, they're, if you said before the season that the Cavs, I mean, they're projected to be fourth in the East right now, and they're only fourth in the East,
and their defensive problems might not be fixable. Yeah. That's the reason I think you can make a good argument with them is this idea that they even if they had just LeBron sat games, which he hasn't really done, if there were circumstances where I could have seen them getting a lower seed, but this way that it happened, that's a good point. Yeah, Cleveland's a good call. I'll say Cleveland is. Yeah, that's true. I guess I've gotten so used to it that it's not as disappointing now, which is funny because the same thing is true for my most disappointing player, and I just haven't gotten used to it because it just pisses me off still.
Well, and consider that their point differential for the season is like pretty much even. You know, I mean, you can say they've gotten lucky, or you could say it's LeBron James being awesome, but they've well outperformed their point differential in terms of the actual wins this year. So fundamentally, you can argue they've even been worse than their record. And then dovetailing with that, even though he's not on the team anymore, is Jay Crowder. Quietly, Crowder in his first time with the Jazz here has been just as bad as he was with Cleveland. I haven't been that locked in on what his defense has looked like since he's gone there, but offensively, 7.6 PR, shooting only 30% from three with the Jazz. So, I mean, he's still the guy for me. I thought he really was like a quality starter on a great contract coming into the season, and just it's really been a disappointment, even if there have been some extenuating circumstances personally for him there. Who is your most disappointing player?
Andrew Wiggins. Wiggins came into this season with the golden opportunity of finally fitting into his spot offensively next to Jimmy Butler, wonderful player, and Karl Anthony Towns, rising offensive star, bare minimum, probably two-way star eventually, or at least one and a half way. So it's like, okay, he's going to take fewer shots, he can excise some of the bad things in the rotation, and also defensively, the idea of playing the second best perimeter player as opposed to the best guy and not having that on his plate. It's like, okay, this is the opportunity for him to show it. This has been his worst offensive season as a professional player. He is...
Really? He's actually worse than his rookie year?
His lowest true shooting percentage, 0.51 as opposed to 0.517. So lowest there.
In a higher offense era now, too, by the way.
In a higher offense era, his three-point attempt rate
With more talent around him. I mean, that's crazy.
Right. It's crazy. And his usage is way lower than last year, but actually higher than that rookie year. Lowest assist rate, which is a problem when you consider the surrounding talent that he has now. And his defense has not been good. And so that's why it's disappointing to me, was that his situation changed for the better, and he has not been able to even just take advantage of that, much less grow with it.
Yeah, it's a concern, although, I mean, it's not as disappointing for me personally, because I never thought he was that good. And he's got a chance to get out of that category now, because he's going to have all he can eat offensively with Jimmy Butler out. Although even then, I would say, hey, maybe they should give a few more shots to Jeff Teague. But he's been a little more efficient. But this next stretch for the Wolves will be quite telling. We're going to get to the Rookie of the Year in the moment. But first thing, why don't you tell people about our Patreon, since we don't have a second ad today. We can do an ad for ourselves.
The Patreon is a great way to support the two of us in our various endeavors. We like to think of it as a great way to support the Twitter NBA show in particular, because it is not sponsored at the moment, and we love doing it, but it's a big time commitment for us. You know, it's basically a night where we're not watching many other games, but we enjoy the process of interacting with everybody else and gaining the experience, you know, calling those games, and we will do it a lot for the playoffs. But then it's not just a handout or something like that, because we give a lot of special content. If you get into the level where we put out material, at least one mailbag podcast per month. This month it'll actually be two, because we still had the holdover from the February one. And Danny Storytime, where I do audio versions of my pieces, salary cap sheets, and whatever else we can think of. I mean, that's part of what we're trying to do with this. It was a new venture when we started it, and we keep on adding stuff. That's how Danny Storytime came about, and a lot of these other things is just people saying, hey, this would be cool, or us thinking, hey, this would be cool. And so you can do that. Patreon.com/DuncanLarue is where you go for it, and it means a lot to us, because it makes the whole system more viable for us to keep doing exactly what we're doing.
Yeah, and that latest mailbag pod that we did was a lot of fun. We talked about which teams, GM jobs we would like to have, rule changes we might want to see, fixing the age limit rules, best point forwards in NBA history. There's a lot of cool stuff that we talked about in that latest pod. All right, now that we teased that, let's get to the real stuff. Rookie of the Year, which maybe to me is the hardest on this board, because at least on the All-NBA stuff, you can kind of go back on what your impressions were of these guys. guys coming into the season. There's a little bit more if you want to just say who's the best player. But man, I mean, this comparison between Donovan Mitchell and Ben Simmons is going to just go right down to the wire.
What I love about it is that they're both incredibly important to their team, and there are certain elements of it that are very similar, but they succeed in different ways. Ben Simmons for the season has taken 35 shots from 16 feet or further, which is incredible for a player who has the ball where he has the ball.
And I bet you he's made less than 20% of those too.
He is at 11 for 35.
Oh, I guess I was wrong then. Okay.
But 0 for 10 from three. So
yeah, some of those are heaves, but yeah, I mean, I don't think he's taken a single three that was like, oh, hey, I actually really want to take this one because I'm open type of three.
Yeah, his shot chart is pretty bonkers, but he still is weird as scorers, because that's what true shooting percentage measures. He and Donovan Mitchell are almost identical, 55% for both of those guys, even though they shoot dramatically different shots and everything else like that. And both guys are better defensively than especially most rookies, but I mean, I think they're both providing value on that end. Mitchell has D'd up a lot of talented guards over the year, and his role shifts based on who else is on the floor with him. And Simmons benefits a lot from being the number three big on it, because they have Covington bounces around a lot, so sometimes those things do fall to Simmons, and Joel Embiid, the defensive player of the year. But he has done a wonderful job in the role that he has been given. So you have scoring, playmaking, and defense, and all of these guys have good cases for all three of those elements.
Yeah, I think you can make the argument that Mitchell is the better defender, at least for what his role is and what he can do physically, but maybe Simmons is more valuable just to his ability to switch and really almost come pretty close to guarding five positions, if not necessarily at an elite level. Both these guys get plenty of steals. Ben Simmons actually has blocked more shots than I would have thought this season. And probably the biggest, the two things in Mitchell's quiver, turns it over way less than Ben Simmons. Ben Simmons turns it over on 19% of his possessions. That's pretty ugly. And that's something that's probably going to continue here, because when the defense can just lay back, you really have to force the ball, whether off the dribble or through passes, into much tighter areas. They're still about equal in their efficiency, their true shooting percentage, but Mitchell's ability to space the floor is important. Simmons, though, his ability to get out and transition and create opportunities for his team that way. They both played nearly the same number of minutes. They've both played exactly 61 games. They're both 21 years old. They are both, I'd say, pretty darn close to the same level of prospects. You know, I think I said Simmons is a little bit better, but you know, given the fact that Simmons, I think, will never really develop a quality jump shot, you still, that probably limits his upside. Maybe you could say that Mitchell is just a nuclear scorer, could have a slightly higher upside than Simmons. Like, I go back and forth on that as well, because I like to break ties in these by getting the guys who are the best long-term prospects, so you don't get these, like, you know, Malcolm Brogdon winning Rookie of the Year type of things that you're just going to look back on and be like, why the hell did that guy win Rookie of the Year when he, you know, ended up his career was as kind of a fringe starter. And then in RPM, they're very similar as well. I guess Simmons, most of his improvement over Mitchell, I shouldn't say improvement, but his advantage over Mitchell in RPM is on the defensive end. Mitchell actually has the higher offensive RPM. Just barely, I'm going to go with Ben Simmons still, but it really is anyone's game. We don't even know how these teams are going to finish out either. It is just so hard. I mean, I'm already second guessing myself, but it's impossible to choose between these two guys right now.
I have Simmons too, and it's brutally close. I think what was the tiebreaker for me is just the way that the Sixers have needed his playmaking. They have a lot of guys who can complete, you know, like Redick, and I think Redick can create more than some people think by virtue of movement, which is a form of shot creation. It's a different type of thing than, you know, dribbling with the ball in your hands and getting a guy open. But Simmons has that responsibility. The Sixers have been very, very good this year, and he has been an important part of it the whole way. So I think it's a certain way where I ended up with this was where kind of both guys are about the same level for outstanding, was I think Simmons has been slightly more valuable just by virtue of how his contribution has gone throughout the year. But Mitchell has been fabulous, and it would surprise me if this ends up being anything other than close, because I think the Jazz are going to win some games late. They'll push into this, and the Sixers are already in it, so it's not that sort of a concern for them. And it's also not going to clarify because Jason Tatum has taken a step back. This is not a big surprise.
Yeah. And well, if you're going to move on before we talk about Simmons, or before we move on from Simmons, I just want to say that part of what makes this so difficult is that Simmons himself is such a rare type of player, mm-hmm, that it's really just hard to evaluate just how good he is on his own. Mitchell is someone who, you know, it kind of does some more traditional things. You can get get a handle on him. He's similar to other players, whereas Ben Simmons, it's really tough to know. And I think even when we see how these guys play in the playoffs, if it gets there, especially Simmons, like that will be, I think, illuminating for me to see, all right, when teams really can lock in on this guy, how effective can he be?
One other small data point I wanted to mention, which I if it is as close as I think it is, I might go more into this rookie of the year question, is that though they don't have great surrounding talent in those circumstances, the Sixers have only scored 101 points per 100 possessions with Simmons on the floor and Embiid off. And Embiid has been a dominant force in both ways. And I think those minutes often commingle with Redick. So it's like, well, yeah, Simmons is a big part of their offense, but maybe it is the beauty of these two guys. And Embiid has been spectacular overall this season. I had him as first team All-NBA. So
I don't hold that against Simmons as much, just because I think up until very recently, their second unit has been so screwed up offensively where they've had to play McConnell with them. They've been playing two bigs with like Booker and like Rashawn Holmes and Amir Johnson. I mean, they just, you know, Covington is out, so they don't, I mean, he's playing with just no shooting whatsoever around him. And when he also can't shoot, I mean, that makes it really difficult. So I think, I think that really is more a product. It could be that he can't do that much without Embiid, but I think he's been placed in an impossible situation there. Third place, I had Jason Tatum, has fallen off, but so have a lot of these other guys. Actually, we talked on the Patreon mailbag today about whether we believe in the rookie wall or not, but still overall in the year, 59% true shooting, solid defensively. I mean, Kyle Kuzma is now below the league average for true shooting, right around average in usage. He's kind of seems to have really fallen off both in his role and his effectiveness, and obviously is pretty bad on D. He also is the worst net rating of any Lakers player who's really a major part of their rotation. So I think it's clearly Tatum at number three, and then Bogdan Bogdanovic, I think, is closing on Kuzma. We'll see how it ends. He could be in that fourth spot by the end of the season.
The other guy I want to mention is Lauri Markkanen. Markkanen has come on a little bit, and he doesn't hasn't provided the defensive value that Jason Tatum has, but I'm intrigued by his offensive capability. And another thing, just a small point to mention, I'm surprised that Markkanen's rebound rate overall is actually, or sorry, his defensive rebound rate, not his overall, his defensive rebound rate is stronger than John Collins. And some of that could be because he sometimes, not anymore, but I've played with Robin Lopez, who was more of a box out guy, and so that can lead to rebounds going to other players. But it just surprised me, so I wanted to mention it.
Yeah, and I'd be interested to see what the on-off differential is between his rebounding when Lopez is and isn't on the floor. But going back to the rookies overall, and this is still a pretty darn good rookie class, but if you look at their overall, you know, whether it's RPM, whether it's PER, whether it's true shooting, I mean, other than kind of the limited center type of guys who just finish stuff and that's how they're efficient, really almost no efficient rookies whatsoever in this class. So a lot of these guys have dropped off a little bit. I mean, it's still, it is a very solid class, but we're also got to keep in mind just that rookies are so often not really any good. Sixth man, I don't think we need to spend a ton of time on. It's obviously Lou Williams. He still easily qualifies for the criteria. Tyreke Evans isn't eligible. I had Will Barton second, and then Julius Randle, who is temporarily eligible here, but has started 30 of 63 games. He's probably going to start the rest of the season, so he won't be eligible at the end of the year. He would probably be number three for me as of this point. Nikola Mirotic hasn't been quite as on fire since going to New Orleans, and he missed, you know, the first month and a half of the season.
Lou Williams, this is the only word to me that basically if he didn't play the rest of the season, I still think Lou Williams deserves it. So for first time of any of these, that's definitely done. There are a lot of players that if you went beyond three that I think would be eligible or capable or whatever. I had Barton second as well. And one guy that I want to mention, not as a sleeper to win the award because Lou Williams is going to win it, but even though he's doing it as a starter right now, which is always frustrating, Satoransky is probably going to be eligible. And if he had played in the beginning of the season, would probably be in my top three. It's just that he didn't at the beginning. So I just want to mention him because he could end up having a good showing on the ballot itself.
Well, and usually we like to devolve away from the scorer is just, you can only be a sixth man of the year if you're some big high scoring guard off the bench. But Luke, it hasn't been a banner year for those type of guys this year, but Luke Mbah-Mute, and the difference in the Rockets defense when he plays it and when he doesn't is absolutely remarkable. Ben Falk wrote about him, and you know, he's missed enough time and hasn't played that many minutes to where he can't really be in this conversation, but he would have to be probably certainly not above Lou Williams, who's having one of the better six-man seasons we've seen in a long time this year. All right, let's get to some of the more fun categories here. Dunk of the month. It was not as good of a month for dunks because we had the All-Star break, and so just
I disagree with that
overall. Oh yeah,
mostly because the top two are spectacular. But so before that, I'll do my other two honorable mentions, which were both notable in their own ways. Damian Lillard's tip dunk on I can't remember what team that was, but he had
the Suns. He went over the back like Chris and Bender or something.
That was bonkers. Awesome. And then the other one, partially because of the impact and surprise of it, Valanciunas's buzzer beater.
That was fantastic, and it should have been an and one. I don't know how that wasn't.
Should have been a foul. And so those two were my honorable mentions. But then I have a clear number two and a clear number one. Number two, which could have been number one in many other months, and I actually got pissed off that NBA.com's thing put it at third on under the LaVine dunk, which was not nearly as good. Was Jared Allen on Lauri Markkanen? That was just nasty.
Oh, that's... what the hell was Markkanen thinking? Like, he came over to try and take a charge. He had no chance of getting there. Maybe if you jump, you might have a chance, although Allen was going to probably dunk on him anyway. But he like comes over. He's not even outside the restricted area and tries to take a charge and just falls down and just gets trucked for the dunk. That was just horrible. And Jared Allen he's had some nice dunks and he's been a nice victim. So he's watching him in Nets games has been exciting. He gets over and contests a lot of shots.
And he could very well be, I think he'll be, I haven't gone through it all the way yet. Second team all rookie. He's having a nice year. I really like Jared Allen. But number one, and it's my dunk of the year to this point. I don't even have to really go through everything. The degree of difficulty on the Giannis alley-oop over Tim Hardaway Jr. is incredible. I mean, you don't see guys jump over other guys in NBA games very often, and there's a reason for it because it is ludicrously hard. And Giannis did it, and it was so seamless that I didn't even necessarily notice it the first time I saw it.
I mean, I've only ever seen it one other time on an alley-oop, and that was the LeBron over John Lucas. And John Lucas is 5'11", and Tim Hardaway is like 6'5". So yeah, Giannis, that was just absolutely ridiculous. I mean, it was still kind of uncontested, so I'm not sure if it's like I'm as high.
It was uncontested because he had to jump over a goddamn person. That counts.
Yeah, but it's still like, you know, when no one is really like the best dunks to me are the ones that just like eviscerate the manhood of like someone who's just like trying to stop you,
like Nance over
and Hardaway. Hardaway just like kind of happened to be there and like wasn't really in position to contest, and Giannis just jumped over him. You know, it was more kind of like he was just like an unwitting prop as opposed to the guy like Markkanen. I mean, not that the Markkanen dunk was better. I had that as my number one this month too, but I don't know if it would be my number one for the year. That Markkanen one was just like, you just like got knocked over, like what are you doing? Like, you know, I enjoy like there's more of a confrontational aspect to it. Another, my number two actually for the was Maxi Kleber on Julius Randle.
That was glorious. I forgot about that dunk. I don't think that was in the NBA montage. It should have been.
It was in the one that I did. You just watch like their top 10 list?
Yeah, because that was actually my favorite beyond the difficulty. I'd forgotten about that dunk. I love that. I think I talked about that one on the podcast because I watched that game and was so excited about it.
No, it was with like, you know, it gave like the Mavs their first clutch win of the season seemingly. But he came down the lane, Randle was there, and I didn't see this until I saw like another angle of it as I rewatched it. And if you guys want to watch this, just Google like NBA best dunks February, and it, like it's the one that just has the montage of all of them. It doesn't rank them. It's like 10 minutes long. That's like the one that I watched to remind myself every month. But he came down, I mean, and it was almost like Dominique style. He went up with two hands and then he pulled it to the side and went around Randall's arm and dunked it. And that was like a minute 30 left in the game. It was just awesome. And especially just like, you know, whenever it's a white guy, you have to give it a little bit more. It's a little bit more enjoyable just because, you know, we are a jumping challenged race, unfortunately.
And while it is not a dunk, I want to give a special mention because we never talked about it on the podcast. To the more disrespectful thing than any of the dunks this month, James Harden on Wes Johnson, which was just ludicrous. And I just wanted to mention it as like that might have been the moment of the month for me.
That was awesome. The other one I wanted to talk about dunk-wise was Jabari dunked with the left on both John Collins and Mike Muscala.
Oh, yeah, that was nice.
One of his first games back. And this actually, if we can learn anything here from the dunks this year, is if you're a young player, like learn how to dunk with your left. That can really lead to a lot more highlights because people just aren't expecting it. You can just get a lot more dunks. You have a lot more versatility to your dunks. Okay, best win of the month.
I try to go with things that affect the way I think about a team. And for me, even though it has changed a little bit in hindsight, right? Oklahoma City beating the Warriors that second time. They won 125-105, completely outclassed them. That was the game when Russell Westbrook had 21 in the first quarter. And I don't know when he turned his ankle, but at some point turned his ankle. We did this game for the Twitter NBA show. I was blown away with how good the Thunder looked in that game. My honorable mentions were Houston just killing the Cavs in Cleveland, even though Cleveland isn't and wasn't their best form then. And the Warriors then getting revenge and having that win over Oklahoma City.
Yeah, that OKC at Warriors was a pretty damn good win. Although for OKC, you wonder why they can't play that well in some of these other games. For me, though, my number one was the Clippers beating the Nuggets in the Boban game. They were just totally out of it, like down like 17 or 18 midway through the third, in the Mile High altitude. They bring in Boban and he and Montrezl Harrell, Ty Wallace, like just bring them back. They end up winning that game against the Nuggets. My honorable mention was the Blazers going into Utah, who had won 11 straight, and just beating the tar out of them, completely shutting them down, 100-81 the first game after the All-Star break. There'll be some good ones already for next month too. I mean, that Blazers win at the Lakers last night was awesome, just because of like that Lillard performance. The Lakers overcoming a 10-point deficit against the Spurs a little bit earlier was pretty good too. Those will be in consideration for next month. Worst loss.
I watched a fair portion of this game, so I feel comfortable putting it. Cleveland led Orlando in Orlando by, I think it was 17 points at halftime. Then they were outscored.
They led by 21 in the third quarter, I believe.
Yeah.
Wasn't in the third quarter. It might have been earlier, but yeah, it was incredible.
Then they were outscored 41-22 in the third and 24-9 in the fourth quarter.
Yeah. They only had 5 points in the first 9 minutes of the fourth. This was on February 6th. Ended up losing by 20. That's it for me as well. Really, nothing else came to mind. That was just awful.
Well, the other two, just in terms of a team clarifying the position, was Boston. They got blown out by the Cavs, and then I think it was shortly thereafter got blown out by the Raptors. I can't remember if the Raptors game was
those were two pretty ugly games too when you're trying to against your chief competition. Those are good ones.
Yeah, so I had that as, because it was like, oh yeah, okay, Boston is they're the second best regular season team in the East. They're not the number one, and so that was clarifying. As you said, this was a short month, as it was, for, and that was affected best dunk. There were an inordinate number of spectacular games like this. Also partially, I think, because I kept better track during the month itself. But
yeah,
the best games, I mean, I'll go through some of the candidates. Cavs Wolves, that was just an absolute blockbuster of an offensive game. LeBron ends up winning it on that shot that was poorly defended by the Timberwolves. Pelicans Heat, Pelicans Bucks, Bucks Raptors, all three of those games later in the month, all three went to overtime and were pretty memorable. And then the one you mentioned before with the Clippers and the Nuggets. And then, do you want me to say my game of the month now, or do you want to wait until you say yours?
No, go ahead.
Nuggets Thunder for me. That was the one when Gary Harris hit that game-winning three. And part of the reason I liked that game so much was because a lot of guys had really good performances. Jokic had that triple-double, 29, 13, and 14. Paul George went for 43. Jamal Murray had 33. And the shot at the end was spectacular. And so I enjoyed that game the whole way through. I thought a lot of guys played well. And then the last shot was just ridiculous.
For me, it was that Minnesota at Cleveland game. An NBA record 43 pointers were made in that game. I didn't get the final total, but at one point in the overtime, there had been 33 lead changes and 15 ties. LeBron James hit some monster threes at the end of regulation and at OT to even make it close. And then, of course, that last shot by LeBron, after LeBron came in and blocked the first shot of the game for either team, just sends Butler shit in the stand, which led to a hilarious moment when Butler was like, oh yeah, that's when I saw him coming, I just threw it up there so he could block it. Like someone asked him about like what he was thinking on the play or something, some dumb question like that. And then obviously that was the one where they threw the ball to James at the free throw line and he hit the fadeaway on Butler from the backcourt after they had screwed up and couldn't advance the ball because J.R. Smith just started dribbling after that LeBron block, I think it was. But to run that play, that was pretty awesome. And then that huge game winner, I mean, that's probably going to be the best game winner that we have this season. But OKC at Denver certainly was right up there as well. All right, we're almost done here. January monthly trend that will continue. I predicted that Oklahoma City would not finish the year in the top five on defense and would continue to get a lot worse without Robertson. They are now 10th overall for the season, and they have the 23rd ranked defense since February 1st per Cleaning the Glass. So that I can chalk that one up in my ledger.
You can. I cannot chalk mine up the same way. I said Minnesota would still take the most mid-range shots per game. They were 24.4 per game in January. They're seventh most, which is still plenty. I mean, they're at 20 per game. But number one was the Knicks at about the same level the Wolves were at before, so I got that wrong. The trend that I said was an aberration. The Golden State Warriors were 27th in defensive rating per cleaning the glass in January. They were fifth in February. I had to use the media site because cleaning the glass was down that morning. But they were still, you know, they were much, much better than that. So that one I will say I got correct.
Yeah, I think we all knew they would get a little bit better. It'd be interesting to see where their D is going forward. My trend that was an aberration was Orlando being absolutely terrible. They were 3-11 in the month of January, but they're only 23rd in net rating. I mean, and at one point I think they had lost like, you know, 30 out of 35 or 29 out of 35 or something. And since February 1st, negative 3.5 net rating, that's 21st in the NBA. That is the best of any of those tanking teams as well. So they've actually been like semi-legitimate. And I think actually trading Elfrid Payton, you can argue, has helped them because they're essentially even on the year when Payton is not on the floor. Again, there could be a lot of luck involved there. They've also just gotten healthier with Aaron Gordon returning, Vucevic returning, John Isaac returning. So I expect them to continue to play way better than would suit them as they did last year down the end of the year.
My trend that will continue for the month of, well, for the rest of the season, because we're not going to do this again until the end of the season. Memphis being the league's worst offense. Their offensive rating for February, 93.5. I don't think they'll be that bad. That's not what I'm predicting. I'm just predicting they'll be the worst in the league.
That's like as bad as the Sixers were in some of those tanking years, and that was in a much lower offense environment back then. I mean, that is just truly horrendous. And I mean, especially if Tyreek Evans misses time, I mean, they've got like Harrison and Chalmers are injured now too. I mean, who knows how many more games Gasol is going to rest. Like, yeah, it could get real ugly. Mine was the Spurs continuing to be, you know, around 500 until Kawhi Leonard gets back. They're at a 0.3 net rating since February 1st, although their clutch luck, which had been awesome, has really turned against them. They've won 2.6 games fewer than expected based on their point differential since February 1st. I mean, I don't think they're going to continue to have a losing record necessarily, but they're going to really be struggling to scrape out some wins, especially if they can't get Aldridge going again after this ankle sprain. Then my trend that I believe is an aberration. The Lakers have a plus 6.4 net rating since February 1st. I don't see that continuing. I think they'll play, you know, around 500 or so ball the rest of the year, especially because while I don't think Ingram has been that awesome of a player this year, they have no other threes on the team. And so it's just really hard to win games when you don't have anybody who's really like an NBA wing player. And Josh Hart is out too.
Yeah, and they will benefit a little bit from playing some of these teams as they have in the recent past who aren't trying as nearly as hard as they are. Like they're playing Orlando on Wednesday, so that will help them. But they don't have, I don't think they have a ton of those games left. They have a few. My trend that is an aberration, and this is again more of a degree thing. Houston had the second lowest turnover rate in the entire NBA in February. And while they have been low this season, partially due to playing a lot more isolation, you don't turn the ball over much when you're in isolation. I just think that being below 12% is, I don't expect that to continue for the rest of the season. And that will hurt their defense a little bit if they have the turnover rate a little bit higher. I still think they're going to have a fabulous end of the season, but I want to keep an eye on that number. And that's part of the reason I chose it.
All right, that'll do it for today. Thanks so much for listening. And we'll be back tomorrow. We're going to have a brand new guest on tomorrow is the hope. So we'll talk to y'all at that point. Till then.